Susan? Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Wright. I didn't hear you coming in. Aren't they fabulous?
Who?
It's John Smith and the Cummermen. They've gone from 19 to 2.
John Smith is the stage name of the Honorable Aubrey Waits. He started his career as Chris Waits and the Carolers, didn't he, Susan?
You are surprising, Mr. Chesterton. I wouldn't expect you to know things like that.
I have an inquiring mind. And a very sensitive ear.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Hello. Rob Reiner is Hollywood royalty. Literally. His father, Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks' writing partner, was there at the dawn of American TV comedy, writing for Sid Caesar in New York City in the early 1950s. Rob himself was one of the four series leads on the seminal 1970s American sitcom All in the Family, which, yes, is Norman Lear's take on the British sitcom Till Death Do Us Part, but the American version has very long cultural legs and launched the younger Reiner into his own stardom. In the 1980s, Rob Reiner was Hollywood's can't-miss director. Imagine those last three words all capitalized. Look at the IMDb Top 250 movie list. There's a lot of Reiner in there. Every movie he directed in the 1980s has had phenomenal cultural impact. Starting with the mockumentary This Is Spinal Tap, these go to 11, and then Stand By Me, which launched four teen actors, including the late lamented River Phoenix, whose eulogy, by the way, appears in the Doctor Who Missing Adventure, Invasion of the Cat People, by two-time guest of this podcast, Gary Russell. The Princess Bride, Inconceivable. When Harry Met Sally, which, in the summer of 1989, was my first date, though that's a story for a later episode, possibly. Moving into the 1990s, Misery, a Stephen King novel adaptation, which relaunched the career of James Caan and helped launch the career of Kathy Bates, and A Few Good Men, an adaptation of the stage play of the same name, which helped cement Tom Cruise's reputation, but it's really good in spite of that. And then came North. In 1994, North was Rob Reiner's first flop. Mega, bona fide, electrified flop. All-star cast from Elijah Wood, whose turn as Frodo, a decade later, generated billions of dollars, to Abe Vigoda, quite possibly my favorite actor of all time, and who, by the way, is buried in the same cemetery as one of my grandmothers. But in spite of the cast and the director, North was just a disaster. A disaster. And then enter Roger Ebert. Ebert, the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times for nearly half a century, then a long-running TV co-host of Siskel and Ebert at the Movies, and a literal Pulitzer Prize winner. One of the last greats of print journalism, with the current consolidated state of corporate-owned media, meaning that film critic is no longer a middle-class career, Ebert had a genius for breaking down movies in less than 1,000 words each. A genius that the author of this podcast's audio essays is sorely lacking. When Roger Ebert explained why a movie was good, or why a movie with a good premise didn't quite work, I always went, ah yes, of course. And when Ebert hated a movie, he elevated the act of criticism into high, high art. You have your great stand-up comedians in America. You have your George Carlin. You have your Albert Brooks. But nothing is funnier. Nothing is funnier than a Roger Ebert review of a bad, bad movie. An excerpt from Ebert's 1994 review of Rob Reiner's North. Quotes, North is one of the most unpleasant, contrived, artificial, cloying experiences I've had at the movies. There is an idiocy here that seems almost intentional, as if the filmmakers plotted to leave anything of interest or entertainment value out of these episodes. I hated this movie. Hated, 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 hated this movie. Hated it. Hated every simpering, stupid, vacant, audience-insulting moment of it. Hated the sensibility that thought anyone would like it. Hated the implied insult to the audience by its belief that anyone would be entertained by it. North is a bad film. One of the worst movies ever. See, I can't even read it without laughing. North is a bad film. One of the worst movies ever made. But it is not by a bad filmmaker, and must represent some sort of lapse, from which Reiner will recover. Possibly sooner than I will. See, just can't get through it without laughing. I will put a link to the full review in the show notes. I dare you to read it out loud without laughing. Which leads us to January 1987, and the novelization of Eric Saward's radio play, Slipback. I hated this book. Hated this book. Hated it. Believe it or not, here we are in May 2024, and I have never read Slipback before. It's one of the very few Target books I'd never read before beginning this podcast. Already this year, 2024, I've read the first two Companions of Doctor Who books for the first time, Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma, and Harry Sullivan's War, both original novels. About Slipback, another book I chose not to buy in the 1980s, as it was based on a radio play I'd both never heard and never heard of, this is also my first time reading. Before opening the book for the first time, still in a plastic sleeve the way that I bought it from Dale Santos at Galley a few years ago, all I knew about the book was what I learned from Wikipedia. Quote, a novelization by Eric Saward was published by Target Books in April 1986, the first novelization of a non-televised Doctor Who story. Saward's novelization expands on the radio play greatly, with an extensive prologue running about a third of the book before the Doctor appears and the adaptation of the radio play storyline begins. End quote. We're going in paperback publication order here on Doctor Who Literature, and the paperback came out 9 months after the hardcover. The radio play was already 18 months in the dust by the time the paperback came out, and Valentine Dial, the lead guest actor, had died even before the radio play's release. So we're already 6 months past the lighting of Valentine Dial's first yardside candle, so to speak. We've talked about Eric Saward on this show before, most notably his novelizations of The Visitation, episode 70 of this podcast, and The Twin Dilemma, episode 103. In short, Visitation is a two-fisted novelization of a Saward script, serious and intense, with good writing, faithful to its TV parent. Twin Dilemma is a farcical comedy, Douglas Adams, but darker, much darker, and as unfaithful to its TV parent as one of its characters, Archie Sylvest, is to his wife. Where does Slipback fall, then? Is it more like The Visitation, or more like The Twin Dilemma? The answer falls on page 14. Quote, when the history of the universe is finally written, it will be seen that wine was the greatest single factor in promoting both artistic and technological evolution. Well, to quote William Hartnell and the Censorites, I rather fancy that settled that little bit of solution. Chapter 1 is all over the place. Saward experimenting once again with Douglas Adams-style storytelling by invented anecdote, fiction by broad comedy, black comedy. We learn about Horace Noakes and Gregory Constantine, but don't get too attached to them. As I said back in the Twin Dilemma episode, named characters and Eric Saward anecdotes don't tend to live long. We also learn about a Time Lord named Vipod Moore and the spaceship named after him. If this podcast ever gets to the new Targets, and to Saward's 21st century novelization of Resurrection of the Daleks, you'll see that ship again. Though, of course, I never want to talk about Resurrection ever again. So if this podcast ends without ever discussing the new Targets, that book will be the reason why. Much of this four-chapter prologue is full of anecdotes and facts that don't matter, but happen to play into Saward's personal beliefs and preferences, one might expect. The story of Noah's Ark is retold in a cynical way. There's a long screed criticizing psychiatrists and psychotherapists. If you knew someone in real life who said the things about mental health treatment that Saward says in this chapter, you'd slowly back away, or at least never talk to them again, unless they were Tom Cruise. The story of Schellingborn Grant, a con man who's taken a 10-year job aboard the Vipod Moor, which is an unusually long contract for a con man, dissolves into the story of one Oliver Sneed, Dr. Oliver Sneed. Honestly, I can't take seriously any story about a guy named Sneed, unless it's about the pro golfer. The name just sounds silly. This chapter goes on for 15 pages, and while it has some amusing lines, it's not the kind of material that we go to Doctor Who books for. Well, by we, I mean me. This is not the style of humor that interests me. On page 36, Sayward likens a woman with a New York accent to, quote, a demented, stereotyped, ditzy dame. And this is where I would have stopped reading if this weren't a Targets podcast, where I've pledged to read every word of every book and bring it on all to you. But we simply cannot go on like this. Let's cue the opening titles.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason. After that cold open, we're going to pretty much get right away to my interview with Keith Say, a longtime panelist over on the Trap One podcast, but Keith's first appearance on Doctor Who Literature and long overdue. This is a great conversation from a guest you might not have heard before. He interviews me nearly as much as I interview him. Listening back to the interview and the edit was even more fun than actually recording it. It's always great to go back and discover an interview as you're putting it together in the edit. Just a wonderful time hearing it back after having been a participant the first time. Hope you enjoy it as much as I did. It has been said there is no such thing as a great interview, only great conversations, and Keith and I certainly have a conversation. You've already heard my thoughts on Slipback. I will now give Keith the next word. He has a much better opinion of it than I do, and we're going to hear why. There is a trigger warning. If you are not familiar with the Chronicles of Narnia, I do, in the course of my conversation with Keith, give away the end of the last book. You might wish to fast forward about 60 seconds once you hear me talking about the last battle. In the news, there are rumors that three new Target novelizations are coming out in the summer of 2024, based on the currently airing Shudi Gatwa Millie Gibbs season, which premiered in the States on Disney Plus on May 10th, which is only about 36 hours ago, as this podcast drops. In my audio essay, following the interview with Keith, I will review the first of those two Shudi Gatwa episodes that dropped on May 10th. But for now, let's talk about Slipback, and let's get to it.
Traveling the Vortex. Are you ready to embark on an epic journey through time and space? Join the thousands of Whovians around the world who've discovered Traveling the Vortex, the ultimate Doctor Who podcast for diehard fans and curious newcomers alike.
Every week, we dive deep into the Whoniverse, discussing the episodes, theories, and hidden gems. We dissect the Doctor's adventures, share behind-the-scenes stories, and explore the legacy of this iconic show.
Traveling the Vortex brings fans together, fostering a global community of Whovians. Whether you're a fan of classic or new Who, there's something for everyone.
Join us on this incredible journey as we unravel the mysteries of time and space.
Don't miss out. Subscribe to Traveling the Vortex today on your favorite podcast platform.
Traveling the Vortex. Your ticket to adventure awaits.
Traveling the Vortex is a proud member of the Direction Point Podcast Network. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Keep turning the pages.
And I want to introduce my brother from the Trap One podcast, but a first-time appearance on Doctor Who Literature, Mr. Keith Say. Keith, welcome to the show.
Hello, it's nice to be here at last. I was struggling to know when I would be on because the book we are discussing just seems to be ignored by everything. It's like I tried to work out when it was published, and in the great David Howe book, it's rarely mentioned. So it's nice to be here.
In my defense, I booked you for this appearance more than 6 months ago, but because bookings for this show are so far into the future, it took a while for your turn to come up. I knew you were on the calendar, but it took a while to get to this book. And now that I've gotten to the book, I wish it had taken even longer. No offense, personally.
Is it not a hidden classic?
So you and I have been on several Trap One episodes together. And one of the few constants in life is that whenever I listen to an episode of All New Adventures of the Doctor Who Book Club podcast, or whenever I check my YouTube notifications, there is always a kind review from you. So I always appreciate your feedback.
Oh, I've always liked the books. There's very few podcasts about them. Yours is one I really enjoy. So, yeah. And it's nice to get views from elsewhere, shall we say. A lot of the stuff I listen to is very UK-centric, so it's nice to have a view from across the pond.
I do bring a very American-centric lean with my refusal to say Dalek and with my constantly talking about American sports.
Yes, that's very baffling.
It definitely stumps Jim Sangster, my co-producer, when he asks me a baseball question, and I'll give him a 7-minute answer, pretty much all in one breath. The only baseball-related reference that I can make to the novelization of Slipback by Eric Sayward is that I would like to take a baseball bat to this book. And I have a baseball bat about 6 feet away from where I'm sitting, but I can't be bothered to get up and slam it. But yeah, one day this book will meet the business end of a baseball bat.
That's very American of you, having a baseball bat within arm's reach.
Well, my daughter is on two different softball teams at the same time right now. So one of them is her wooden bat and one of them is her aluminum bat, which is not the same aluminum bat used by Sophie Aldred in Remembrance of the Daleks, but it is a reasonable facsimile thereof.
Which, of course, for most British viewers, it's the only reference we have to baseball bats is Remembrance of the Daleks, basically, isn't it?
I did appreciate in the Mike Tucker and Robert Perry Seventh Doctor, Past Doctor novel, Illegal Alien, there was a whole page of the Seventh Doctor discussing baseball with an American bartender. Possibly my favorite page in all of Doctor Who literature.
That's so long ago since I read that. I don't even remember that being in it. I vaguely remember the Simon being in it. So,
yeah, I read that probably in 1997 or 1998, whenever it came out. I've never read it again, and I have no recollection of anything except that one page.
I've got the audiobook, which I've never played. But one day...
Who narrated the audio for that one?
I have no idea. I can't remember.
So let's talk a little bit. Since this is your first appearance on Doctor Who Lit, let's talk a little bit about your fandom origin. And we'll talk about where Slipback fits into your life. Now, I'm not saying that you sit around 24 hours a day thinking about Slipback, but it has to slot in there somewhere. When did you first discover Doctor Who?
Well, I am very, very old, so I first remember seeing Death to the Daleks. And I can remember the exact moment with perfect clarity. It's when the Dalek gets knocked into the water by the probe. And that's the moment that grabbed me, and that's the moment that makes me a fan. And false memory syndrome, I thought it was a compilation episode nearer to Christmas, and apparently that didn't exist. So I must have been aware of the actual broadcast when it was actually shown at the time. I got no recollection of Monster of Peladon, which is probably sensible of me. But then I do remember the Christmas or New Year repeat of Planet of the Spiders sitting in, I was a very tiny child, with my sisters who were 12 years older than me, hiding behind me with a Christmas tree in the background. That's another early memory, but it was Death of the Daleks that grabbed me and made me a fan. In fact, it was the Daleks that grabbed me as a kid more than the Doctor. I was a Dalek fan before I was a Doctor fan, which was a shame, really, because I just became aware of the show when they were hardly in it.
I have vivid memories of the first time that I saw Death to the Daleks, because it aired on PBS on the New Jersey station that was doing one Pertwee omnibus every Saturday night. And they would have aired Death to the Daleks for the first time in July 1985. That was the week before I went to my first Doctor Who convention, July 27th, 1985, at the now defunct Roosevelt Hotel on Madison and East 45th Street in Manhattan. And that weekend, the convention showed an omnibus of Dalek Invasion of Earth, because the William Hartnell syndication package was just about to come to the United States for the first time. So that would have been its first American screening, I think. And I vividly recall sitting there on a hard folding chair in the hotel ballroom being amazed that the Dalek flying saucer prop in 1964 was very similar to the Death to the Daleks flying saucer prop in 1974 that I had seen 1 week earlier. That's an odd memory to have, but I'm full of odd memories, and that's certainly one of them.
There wasn't much innovation in British cake tins, apparently. That's ironic. You probably saw Hartnell before I did then, because we just didn't get repeats, and his episodes didn't come out on video till later on. So, gosh, you probably saw more Hartnell than I did.
That same New Jersey PBS station, New Jersey Network, got the Hartnell package in September 85, and they created this 30-minute documentary called Doctors Who Old and New. And it was hosted by Patrick Daniel O'Neill and Eric Luskin, one of whom later went on to be the narrator of their making-of documentary for Silver Nemesis, which aired in PBS reruns for years. And they talked about getting the Hartnell package and the Troughton package and the Colin Baker package. So they showed a 60-second clip from Unearthly Child and a 60-second clip from The Crotons. And they listed the episodes that they were going to be showing. And this was when I first learned that a lot of Doctor Who didn't exist anymore. Because I was hoping that when they got the package, I was going to get to see, you know, Marco Polo or The Tenth Planet. But it turns out at the time, they only had 17 extant Hartnell packages and 5 Troughtons, beginning with The Dominators, Hello Fraser, which, as it turns out, I wish they'd, you know, kind of lost along the way.
Oh, how could you?
But yeah, I started watching every Saturday night. It was a Hartnell, a Troughton, and then the last Saturday of the month was always one Colin Baker. So it took about 6 months to get through all of season 22. But I was a very excited young fan. So yeah, thanks to PBS, I was able to watch each of the first 5 Doctors within my first year of discovering the show. Each of the first 6 Doctors, I should say.
So what grabbed your imagination about Doctor Who being America, not being, because I mean, in this country, it's part of the culture, really. Was so, what as an American grabbed you about the show?
That's really hard to answer, but I've been putting together my childhood memories of what my childhood obsessions were, because I didn't discover Doctor Who until I was 11, so I was about 5 or 6 years older than most UK fans were when they discovered the classic series. So I had run through Mickey Mouse, which was my first obsession when I was 3 and 4. I had run through Peanuts. I had run through the Hardy Boys novels. I had run through the Choose Your Own Adventures. And everything that I was enjoying between ages 3 and 11 was children's literature or children's television. I don't know if I could put into words exactly what about Doctor Who appealed to me. But I had a sci-fi upbringing. I knew a lot about Star Trek, even though I wasn't a regular watcher at that point. I think it was the fact that it was an adult show, and it was a time travel show. And some of the first episodes that I saw were historicals, which covered the same period that I was learning about in school. Like, King's Demons aired at the exact moment that we were doing a months-long section on medieval Europe for my 6th grade class. And then it was the juxtaposition of a sailing ship in Enlightenment, which turns out to be a spaceship, or the notion in Modron on Death that the Doctor can regenerate, but he's going to give away all of his regenerations to Modron and his companions. That stuff just illuminated me in a way that the Hardy Boys books and the Choose Your Own Adventure books were no longer doing. So I was ready for more adult material, and Doctor Who gave it to me. And I just became, within a month, I became obsessed with the show, and I discovered the books. And of course, the books immediately slotted in where I had been reading 90% Hardy Boys or 90% Choose Your Own Adventures in 1983 and 84. By 1985, 90% of my reading is Doctor Who. So I think it was the content of the show and the books. And that was the next question that I wanted to segue to ask you. You discovered the show in 1974. Which is when the Target line basically launches, because the first original Targets, not counting the Hartnell reprints, come out in January 74. When did you discover the books? When did you start collecting the books?
they were on the shelves of shops. You'd go in and they were just there. By the time I became aware of them, and the covers were what fascinated me, because you had these sort of Chris Sakilios covers, which are always sort of like wonderfully bizarre and sort of like inspiring. And it was the covers that drew me to them. The first book I actually bought was Revenge of the Cybermen, which cost the grand total of 45 pence. Bearing in mind they're about £12 a throw now, they were remarkably cheap. And I had some money. I wanted a Darley book. There wasn't one, so I got the next best thing, which was Cybermen. And I was too young to read it properly. I must have been about 5 or 6, something like that, when I got it. And my sister read me the first paragraph before I went to bed, about going down the corridor full of dead bodies, and it freaked me out so much she had to read me something else before I go to sleep. But the first book I actually read, I could call like an actual proper book, a grown-up book in my mind, was Day of the Daleks. And that was the first book I read from cover to cover as a grown-up reader, so to speak. I must have been about, 6, 7, something like that. And yes, that's quite a proud moment for me as a child. I've been, somebody says, who was your greatest influence in reading? And it's probably Terence Dix, because so much of his writing was what I read as a child and got me into reading.
It's funny that you mention that, because children's literature now, at least sitting in 21st century America, is so heavily regimented. Books are broken up by skill level. If you're in an elementary school classroom, you're assigned a reading group, and you can only read books out of the bucket for the letter group that you're assigned to, starting with A and going up to Z or Z. It just wouldn't be now that a child is going to read Terence Dix or the equivalent at age 6. You're not going to hand a kindergarten or first grade student in the United States a book with a body count like that. So yeah. We, I think, were privileged to grow up in the 70s and early 80s when we did, because we were able to read anything. And we were able to read challenging and visceral material at an inappropriately young age. And I just don't know if that sort of thing happens nowadays.
Plus, I had older sisters, and I could like look at their bookshelves as well, because they, all my family, are just voracious readers. You can see my house there, it's full of bookshelves. My sister's house is exactly the same. So I would look at their books, and they had the Star Trek, they had the photo novels, and they had the books, which were sort of like precis of each of the, like, novelizations of the episodes as well. So I would look through them. So again, novelizations of things was quite normal to me. So novelizations of Doctor Who just was like second nature, really. Plus, there was no videos. So the only way to get these stories for us in the UK, because there was no repeats, was literally to get the books. Then we got the video recorders and ruined it.
I will say that I discovered the Chronicles of Narnia when I was about 6 or 7, because the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe animated movie had just come to television at about that time. And I got a copy of The Last Battle out of the library, and I read the whole thing, and my father quizzed me to make sure that I understood what I was reading. And after I passed his quiz, he then bought me a slipcase of the whole series, which I still have. But years later, when I was pushing 40, I went back and I reread The Last Battle for the first time, and I don't understand how that book didn't destroy me, because that is the most disturbing book ever written, especially at the end where everyone dies and Aslan destroys the universe. And in the last couple of chapters, you learn that they're happier dead in heaven than they ever were alive on Earth. How that book did not shatter and ruin me at age 6 or 7, I have no idea. My 38-year-old self was appalled that I ever read that as a first grader.
Spoilers for those who haven't read it, obviously.
Yes, spoilers for a 70-year-old novel.
There was somebody on the radio complaining that somebody had ruined Romeo and Juliet's ending for them the other day, so who knows?
I'll go put a spoiler warning to the introduction to this episode, which I have not recorded yet. Warning, there will be spoilers for the Chronicles of Narnia.
And baseball, presumably.
And if you haven't read the Chronicles of Narnia, Don't.
No, it wasn't. That's something we weren't going to got in my house. My parents were very devout atheists, so anything like that just didn't really feature in our household. It was more sort of like James Bond and Agatha Christie.
Although the James Bond novels are equally disturbing for their heavily racist and anti-Semitic comments, so that could easily warp you as well for different reasons than C.S. Lewis.
And incredibly lurid covers. That was, as a small child, it was always the covers that drew me. And covers of books in the 70s were bizarre. Like, all the Agatha Christie novels were sort of released with these sort of like horrific covers. I mean, one of which was used as part of the Unicorn and the Wasp, of course. And the James Bond covers were very lurid, and just like book covers were lurid, and horror novels, they were just, I mean, really truly disturbing covers would be on the bookshelves. So there'd be sort of like the Rats book cover would be next to the Green Death books cover in like little corner shops, which would always seem to have a little rack of novels going yellow in the corner.
The James Bond novels especially would have, you know, half-dressed women on the covers, and I guess a lot of 6 and 7-year-olds no longer grow up with that sort of thing in their household.
Nope, and the world is better for it, I suspect. But one thing that James Bond did say was that homosexuals can't whistle, and as it turns out, in my case, completely true. So they're more accurate than we thought.
My parents warned me when I was 11 or 12 that whatever I did, I should never read The Book of Skulls by Robert Silverberg because I would find that too disturbing. So decades later, I found a cheap paperback copy of that at Forbidden Planet in NYC. Book of Skulls is about 4 New York college students who learn about an immortality cult in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's 4 of them, and the book is told in alternating chapters, so it's 4 narrators throughout the book. And the first half is their experiences driving across country, typical college kids. And then the second half is they get to this immortality cult, and they have to go through rituals. And it turns out that for the 4 of them to be granted immortality, one of them has to commit suicide, and another one has to be murdered by one of the survivors, and then the 2 who live will both get immortality. So it's a good read, but obviously it's
cheerful read.
Heavy content.
Not many jokes.
When I saw a copy of the book, I'm like, my parents banned me from reading this. Now that I'm an adult and I see a $2 copy, I'm going to buy it and read it. It turns out it was the homosexual content in the book that they probably objected to, because one of the characters is gay and out, and the other one is heavily in the closet, and that ends up having a significant impact on the finale of the book. I think that was the specific reason why I wasn't allowed to read it. My parents didn't want me getting ideas.
Shocked and stunned.
So your earliest Who memory, season 11.
Yep.
What was your earliest memory of Tom Baker, and did you have a problem adjusting from the John Pertwee era to the Tom Baker era?
Nope, it seemed perfectly natural. I'd seen the bloke with the white hair and the big nose turn into the bloke with the dark hair and the big nose, like on New Year's, like just before New Year or just at New Year. And then literally it felt like a week later, which probably wasn't, but it was very close by. The new bloke appeared and was fighting a giant robot. And big memory of that was my aunts used to live in these horrible flats with like this strange entranceway, and it just reminded me of the place where Sarah discovers the giant robot, so that became linked in my mind. And for some reason, Doctor Who became linked with events around me, so it just fired my imagination. So Tom, if anybody says to me, who are your favourite doctors, I always say the 2 Bakers, because that's essentially true. I mean, growing up as a kid with Tom Baker was amazing, and then I met him at a cricket match, and he was huge, and I was so scared of him. I remember that. That was, I've still got a picture of that. Anybody sort of puts up their picture of them now meeting Tom Baker, I was like instantly put up this picture of me as a kid with Tom Baker, as he was looking exactly like the Doctor in those days, because he was recording the show. So, but yes, so watching Tom Baker, and then Star Wars came out. So that became a major influence. So I was definitely science fiction then. So I used to alternate between Doctor Who and Star Wars, which toys became the top of the pile is what I was into at the time. So if I got me Dennis Victor, Tom Baker out, I was into Doctor Who. And if I got the Star Wars action figures out, I was into Star Wars.
So between 1975, which is the bulk of Tom Baker's first season, and 1985, when Slipback comes on the radio, all three Star Wars films come out, 77, 80, 83. At some point, did you start to compare Doctor Who negatively to Star Wars?
Nope. They were totally separate in my mind. One was BBC and one was feature films. And to my mind, they were absolutely separate but equally enjoyable. I was, these days I've got action figures for both, and I always know there's been a knotwee in the house if I find the two being mixed on the shelves. But I was quite compartmentalised in my head. I would be massively into Doctor Who and totally focus on that, and then I would completely drop it to be completely focused on Star Wars. Then I would drop that to be completely focused on Sapphire and Steel, and then I would go back onto being completely focused on Doctor Who again. So I would just alternate between my science fiction interests or obsessions or expense, because I'm a collector. I was a collector, so thankfully for my poor parents, there wasn't the amount of merchandise that there is today, but there was the Star Wars merchandise, of which I had all the action films for the first two films and most of the play sets. And then I sold the whole lot for £25 when I was 18, and I've regretted it from that moment onwards, because they were keeping me now. That could have been my pension.
That is a physically painful memory.
And I sold all my Lego at the same time. So for £50, I lost all my space Lego and all my Star Wars things. Ugh. And that sort of like put me on the road now to like hoarding everything, because now I think, what have I got which could be is worth as much as Star Wars figures now? So consequently, I don't get rid of anything. As you can probably see looking around my house.
When I think about my first generation 1977 Kenner Star Wars and 1980 Kenner Empire Strikes Back figures, when I think about the fact that I had a Star Wars Death Star Play-Doh set with molds to make Play-Doh, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Obi-Wan Darth, and there was a vinyl placemat where you could have Play-Doh, Obi-Wan, and Play-Doh Darth fighting their battle. When I think about how much money I would have today if I just left those sealed in their original packages in the late 70s and 1980 and never played with them, I'd probably be living in a palatial estate rather than a two-bedroom apartment in New York City. Had I only known then what I knew now.
The worst thing is when you get drunk one night talking about your old Star Wars figures, then you get wistful about it, then you go home and you go onto eBay, then you forget about it, then a few days later you're getting all these alerts on your phone to all the action figures you've spent a huge amount of money for, your bids have won on eBay, then you get them back later in your life.
At 10 or 20 or 40 times the cost.
Yes.
Which is what I'm going through now, recollecting the new adventures.
That's slightly different reasons, though, to be fair.
Yes. So what I'm working with my way up to is, if John Pertwee and Tom Baker are the doctors for you, how did you react to Peter Davison in 1982? How did you react to Colin Baker in 1985?
Well, anybody who listens to Trap One will probably won't be a secret for that. I am rather – you're being savaged by a cat there. Speaking of Colin Baker.
Yes, I am.
I was not terribly keen on Peter Davison, mainly because A, he'd been in All Creatures Great and Small, and B, he'd followed Tom Baker, so naturally I was going to be down on him. And then, so after 3 years of Captain Beige, Colin Baker came along, and I adored him. I mean, I often say Colin, the Sixth Doctor, is my favourite, and it's mostly true. I sometimes just say it to irritate other fans, but mostly Colin Baker is my favourite Doctor, really. And like, just after 3 quite dull years, Twin Dilemma came on, and it was marvellous. I adored it. I voted Twin Dilemma as my favourite story of that season for my Dwas vote. And this is completely true. And I voted Caves of Androzani about, I don't know, third from the bottom, because it was dull with no proper monsters in it. And so it was like Resurrection of the Daleks was my second favourite story that year, which is an Eric Sayward story with lots of deaths. And then it was Twin Dilemma, which was brilliant. I loved it, and I couldn't wait for the next series, and I adored season 22. I was a teenager. I was thinking I was, like, violence was grown up, So I loved it.
Slip Back comes on as a radio play in 1985 after Attack of the Cybermen through Revelation of the Daleks, season 22, has already aired. Were you sitting there listening with rapt attention to the 10-minute installments of the 6-part Slip Back?
No, because I couldn't find it. It was on something called Pirate Radio 4, which was on this strange thing which was just like new to us all called FM. And I thought, what is this? Because Radio 4 was usually on long wave in these days. I mean, we're talking like the 80s now. Aren't we? Sort of 86, is it? 85, 86? And no, I went through all the stations up and down, couldn't find it. So I missed the first part and the second. Was it 2 parts a day or something like that? But anyway, no, I missed it entirely. So now I've been racking my brains to think, did I read the book before I bought the cassettes? So I'm not quite sure in my head now if I'd read the book before I heard it, or whether I heard it, then I got the book. So I think the book, because I was still living at home, so it must have been before I came to live in Carlisle, which was in 89. So, but I can't remember if I read the book first or heard the cassette version.
And I will say that you are the second hardest working podcaster in Carlisle, which is home of our friend Mark from Trap One.
I am. He lives on the top of the hill with the gentry, and I live at the bottom of the hill where the houses that are falling down. I know my place.
So when would you have bought Slip Back the book? The hardcover comes out in 86, probably about a year after the radio airing. And the paperback comes out in January 1987, which is where we are talking about it today.
I must have bought it fairly close to when it was released. I was looking out for it. By that point, I was sort of clued up. I was sort of like saying in bookshops, when is such and such being released? And we kind of knew by this time when things were being released, because it was in Doctor Who Monthly. I think we were monthly by then rather than Doctor Who Weekly. I don't think we'd become Doctor Who Magazine by then. Or maybe we had. Yeah, we were Doctor Who Magazine then. So I knew it was coming out, so I think I bought it fairly sharpish when it was released. And then I remember reading it on a canal boat.
A canal boat?
I was on a canal boat holiday with a group of lads from school, and I'd kind of got out of the way of thinking Terence Dix was the best thing ever, because I was probably over-familiar with it. And then this new writing style by Eric Sabert was in the book, and I devoured it, I have to say.
Huh.
Rereading now for this podcast, I devoured it. I was a big fan of Douglas Adams at the time, so naturally this book was ersatz Douglas Adams, so I loved it. And then, because the narrowboat holiday was quite boring, we were all sort of swapping books with each other, and I was sort of like, of all the books I had, which are fairly Doctor Who, this was an old one I thought my sort of like trendy friends would like to share, so it was that one, and I can't remember what the other one was, but I remember giving it to a lad called Simon Jordan to read, and his review it at the time was, it's shit. So after he read it, that was his review.
Oh, that is a much more succinct way of what I'm going to be saying during the audio essay that follows this interview.
But rereading it, I have to say, I remember I liked it at the time, because basically anything Sixth Doctor I would devoured, but rereading it now, you'd be hard-pressed to guess it was a Sixth Doctor, to be fair.
Eric Sayward structures the book by writing a 4-part epilogue, or a 4-chapter epilogue, I should say, and it takes several dozen pages before the Doctor even shows up.
Page 51. The Doctor first appears in phase 51, and the actual radio play starts on page 34. So prior to that, it's all build-up.
Invented material.
But it made me think about the modern novelizations, to be fair, because, I mean, a lot of them go down different routes, don't they? So you get the Mark Gatiss who will sort of like create a whole new story, or you'll get sort of the stories which just sort of like have lots of character descriptions, or like little vignettes with different characters, like the Rob Sherburn one. So this one is definitely like a whole chunk of new stuff before the actual story proper starts.
Why do you think Sayward structured the book the way that he did? Is that he didn't really care about Doctor Who and wanted to tell his own story? Or was he intentionally trying to do something other than the usual what at the time was the target house style of the Doctor appearing in the first chapter.
I think he was just doing his I'm not very keen on the Sixth Doctor Colin Baker thing, I'll exclude him. Plus he wanted to be Douglas Adams. As I say, the first bit, especially the first chapter, is pure I want to be Douglas Adams. It's all sort of things about strange theories of the galaxy and these characters who hired it and all these folks getting drunk and like wine being this and alcohol being inspiring the universe. And there's bits later about poetry causing monsters to regurgitate people. She's basically Vogue on poetry. And I think he was trying to write a Douglas Adams novel. Perhaps he liked the idea of getting some Douglas Adams type money.
Is it as funny as Douglas Adams? Is his worldview as refreshing as Douglas Adams? Or is he just coming from too dark of a place to make it work? Because I had the same question about Twin Dilemma.
I mean, I have quite a dark sense of humour. There's one bit on the reread that did make me laugh when Slam sort of like created a virus that killed his brother and he was delighted by it. That made me laugh. But I remember I thought it was funny when I first read it as a 16-year-old, but then Death, Doom, and Disaster is quite funny when you're that age. Now, I have to say, rereading it now, and especially, and this is going to sound incredibly po-faced, but lots of the violence, and a lot of the violence towards Perry, I found actually quite unsavoury. There's one bit where she's basically been beaten up, and she wants to kill two characters. I thought, well, that's an addition we could probably have done without, frankly.
There does seem to be a lot of violence and misogyny in especially season 22, which is almost a raw expression of Eric Saward's id, as he was responsible for most of the scripts that year. And we see it time and again with Perry.
But he was just trying to rewrite Kaiser Randazzani, basically, wasn't he? That was a big success. So he took, instead of the sort of like the character interplay and sort of like the plotting being what he took from that, he took the sort of the misogyny and the violence from it and sort of put that into every single story, apart from maybe Marcus Rani that year. So I think that was just him taking the wrong lesson of what made Androzani successful, in effect, wasn't it?
This is a point that I've made on this show before, although not in your presence. Caves of Androzani works because the Doctor comes to a world where it's two sides fighting against each other, manipulated by a third side, and all three sides are awful. The Doctor comes in as a gleaming paragon of virtue, and the mere fact of his goodness changes the motivations of the other characters. Then they all turn on each other because they all believe the Doctor is a double agent. They all believe the Doctor is wrapped up in this grand conspiracy when the Doctor is just trying to save Perry's life. That's a very Robert Holmesian style plot. So the Doctor is a catalyst that sets the book in motion because his presence as a force for good takes all these other forces of evil and makes them collapse on each other. And by the end of the book, all that is left standing is the Salatine android, literally. Everyone else is dead, except for the woman on the other planet who never meets the Doctor, Cryotimid, and she reigns supreme at the end of the day. But then you have Eric Saward taking the lessons of Caves of Androzani and applying them to Revelation of the Daleks exactly a year later, then what do we have? We have violent misogyny with the character of Tassenbeaker and the death of Eleanor Braun's character. And instead of the Doctor being a catalyst who makes a story happen, the story happens entirely without the Doctor's involvement. And if the Doctor never lands on Tranquil Repose, everything in that story still happens in the exact same order. So, Eric Saward doesn't seem to understand what made Caves of Androzani work, and all he saw about it were the bad parts. So, I happen to like Revelation primarily because of the way Graham Harper directed it, Graham Harper who also directed Caves of Androzani, but Eric Saward's worldview, I think, is incompatible with mine. That's my main takeaway.
Mm. I mean, even the bits I did like in the book, there's a charming bit where the Doctor just watches these little mice, but that ends up being related to a story where spaceships have fallen apart and killed people. And the bit where the steward sort of like dies, and the description of his death sort of like dying, not really understanding about the world and like not really understanding why this is happening, stuff like that. And that's nicely written, but that's based on his death as well. He's basically burning alive where he's killing Slan. So Yeah, and all the jokes, I mean, there's jokes about spaceships blowing up, and that's basically death-related. It's very dark. I mean, as a teenager, I adored that, to be fair. I mean, anything dark meant grown up, and so I think, and I was had a bit of a horror bent naturally anyway. If I wasn't reading Doctor Who books, I was reading horror books, so it was like grist to the mill, really. But I think reading it back now, it's too dark for its own good sometimes. It doesn't go with a comedy, because a lot of it is quite lighthearted, and it's a hard trick to pull off. I'm not entirely sure he does.
Where does the book fit for you now? You've reread the book.
I have to say, it wasn't a chore reading it, though. I read it in one sitting. I mean, unfortunately, a week ago, so probably my memory is not as fresh as if I'd read it yesterday. But I didn't find it a chore to read. I mean, it flowed well enough. I mean, in terms of, if you just want to do a prat crit on it, I mean, you could say that maybe establishing the main characters could have been done better, because there's not even nobody reacts to the fact the Doctor's wearing a multicoloured coat. You think, well, surely somebody would, because it's not even described in the book. So there's an assumption that people reading it know who the main characters are. So if you were just literally picked it up as a book not knowing who the central characters are, you wouldn't have a clue, really. It was just like these two people are in a time machine, but you wouldn't know who they were. Since, I suppose, structurally as a book, it doesn't work. But rereading it, it wasn't a chore. The biggest problem I had was the book is now so old, the pages have gone quite yellow, and it was sometimes a bit hard to read with my elderly eyes, but it wasn't a hot chore to read. I'm not sure I will probably read it again as long as I live, maybe, but I'm quite fond of Slipback. I've re-listened to the radio play a lot. When I do my grand rewatches, I always include it, because I always think it kind of fits as canon, because it was broadcast between Revelation and Trial, so in a way, it's sort of bit like Pescatons. It was a product of its age. It's not like The Big Finish, which was sort of like produced later. So it is contemporary, shall we say.
I did include Slipback in my Twitter pilgrimage in 2021, but
both of whom we've now lost access to our Twitter pilgrimage, because we're neither of us on Twitter anymore.
You and I both deleted our Twitter on the exact same day.
Good grief.
What's funny is I went over to Blue Sky, which was a creation or a co-business project of Jack Dorsey, who had founded Twitter. Jack Dorsey has since quit Blue Sky, deleted his account, and gone back to Twitter. So I wonder what that means for Blue Sky's long-term future. That's a stunning betrayal on his part, going back to the evil mothership.
I suppose if you want influence, then Twitter is still has more influence than other social networks. So I guess it's a power thing. But I just found it getting it. It was disturbing me. It just revolted me most of the time. So I do not miss not being on it.
I know the first time that I heard Slipback was in 1997. My friend Trina, that I knew from Doctor Who fandom, and I drove from Ohio to Florida for spring break of that year. And she had it on audio cassette. We played it while driving down somewhere between Tennessee and South Carolina. So I know that I've heard it, but when I try to watch it again or listen to it again for Twitter, I just couldn't get into it. And it just none of it landed for me, and the book landed for me even less. That's why I'm glad I spoke to you, because you're giving me a positive take, which is a nice counterpoint to my own.
Plus, I mean, I adore the Sixth Doctor. At the time, there was very little of him. So like Slipback was great because it was a bit more of the Sixth Doctor. And it was sort of, it's the last time that Peter Howell music's used. In a lot of ways, it's the end of an era as well. Now, I'm not sure the production of it, but what does astound me about it is it's the first time sort of like Saywood has been released from TV budgets, and like the first proper BBC radio version of Doctor Who. And it's all set in corridors. You think the first time you've got a story that could escape corridors, and you've literally set it in a studio set, which just struck me as a little odd, but and perhaps a little unimaginative. But was J&T actually involved in this, or did it have a different producer? I've never been sure. I could have looked it up, but I haven't. But I was never sure whether this was sort of like Saywood being able to write away from J&T's influence, or whether J&T still had a roving brief, because he did over the books at this point. So I suspect the novel was still under his purview, but I wasn't sure if the radio series was. But if it wasn't, then it's strange how the thing he wrote was very similar to the kind of stuff he wrote on TV anyway.
Well, I have dipped into the fact machine. So according to Wikipedia, the producer of Slipback was a gentleman named Paul Spencer, who, that can't possibly be right, because according to the Wikipedia page for Paul Spencer, he was born May 19th, 1971, which makes him 15 years old. So that has to be a different Paul Spencer and an incorrect hyperlink. And the executive producer is Jonathan James Moore. This airs in July and August 1985, quote, 4 months after the final episode of Doctor Who's 22nd season, during the program's enforced hiatus. It was the first Doctor Who serial produced as a radio play. No further radio productions were mounted until John Pertwee reprised his role in Paradise of Death and Ghosts of Endspace. So the Wikipedia page doesn't tell us much about Paul Spencer or Jonathan James Moore, only to say that John Nathan Turner, unless the fact machine is incorrect, has zero fingerprints on this story.
So all these years that Sayward's been blaming J&T for the quality of scripts and stuff, like the effects on his writing and this kind of stuff, when he was actually released from it, he more or less wrote exactly the same he did when he was being produced by J&T.
Including budget cuts, as you say, by setting the entire story in a single corridor set. What I want to do now is introduce a new game segment to Doctor Who literature, and it's fitting because you're a first-time guest. What I have, I am putting down the Slipback novelization, and I can assure you I'm never picking it up again. And what I purchased at Dragon Castle Books in Las Vegas last month is a book that I had as a child and lost during the Great Purge of My Stuff. This is the second Doctor Who quiz book by Nigel Robinson, who has recorded material for Doctor Who literature, which I will be playing in a future episode. Part of my Vorp interview with him. This quiz book is a series of 20 question quizzes covering multiple topics throughout Doctor Who's history. Topics include Adventures of the First Five Doctors, as the book came out in 1983 before you had season 21 or Colin Baker. You also have sections on The Earth in Danger, Companions of the Doctor, The Key to Time, The Master, Adventures in History. And I want to ask you questions on Companions of the Doctor.
Oh, right.
So this is page 19 of the quiz book. Companions of the Doctor, quiz 1.
This is where I get deeply embarrassed, is it? Right.
We're going to ask you the first 5 questions, but the first question is a multiple choice.
All right.
Identify these Companions of the Doctor. A, she regarded the Doctor as almost as clever as herself.
Zoe.
1B. She considered using the Doctor as a case history in her thesis.
Romana?
Yes, but to be more specific, which Romana?
Romana 1, I would imagine.
Yes, very good. 1C. She was the secretary of an eminent scientist.
Polly.
1D. She was offered the chance to start a new life on the planet Skaro.
Oh, Joe Grant.
1E, the mouth on legs.
Poor old Tegan.
Question 2, which of the Doctor's companions was almost eaten alive by ants?
Ian Chesterton.
3, which of the Doctor's companions became the chosen one of Alcon?
Oh, Adric.
Question 4. Why, at the end of The Hand of Fear, did the Doctor leave Sarah Jane?
She didn't want to renew her contract, or he was going back to Gallifrey.
Actually, in her defense, Elizabeth Sladen was due to leave at the end of season 13, but she liked the script for Mask of Mandragoras so much that she stayed on longer, just so she could be in it.
Hoping for an Italian holiday she never got, yeah.
Question 5. Which of the Doctor's companions first met at the Inferno Disco in Covent Garden in 1966?
Ooh, it'll be Ben.
I'm going to give you full credit for that. The answer is actually Ben and Polly, but since Polly was already an answer in question 1, I will give you full marks. Very good.
Oh, thank you. Excellent.
I remember that my mother would quiz me through these books, but because I had not seen all of Doctor Who yet, I didn't really know all the answers. And reading it now, 40 years later, I've actually forgotten some of the answers here. But you did remarkably well.
Are all the answers still correct as well? Because we've discovered a lot of things about Doctor Who now which were presumed to be correct at the time, which turned out not to be correct. So it'll be quite interesting when you go through them, where some of the answers are sort of like being made incorrect by history.
I do know that there's one question somewhere. I don't know if it's the second or the third quiz book. I never had a copy of the first one. There is a question about which is the first Doctor... Oh, I see Smudge.
Oh, you've just been attacked by a cat again.
Smudge just hurtled over the laptop and over the pile of targets behind it to the other side of the table, and now she's staring at me over her shoulder. Very athletic for a house cat. But there was a question in one of the quiz books about which is the first Doctor Who story to have the Doctor's face in the opening credits, and then the answer is, appropriately enough, the faceless ones. And we now know that is wrong. It was actually the Macro Terror.
Macro Terror now, yeah. There's also like these facts like The Edge of Destruction was only written because the sets for a certain thing for Marco Polo weren't built, and that wasn't correct. It was actually written to fill up a 13-episode thing. So a lot of the stuff we knew to be right were actually, as it turned out, completely wrong.
The DVD, especially the Blu-ray, and I can see the entire Blu-ray collection behind you, but having access to the audio commentaries and the text production notes, and especially the BD-ROM production files, we learn a lot more than we did from these books, because the people writing these books were going off of fan wisdom and received wisdom and early research from the 70s, but now we have access to the entire archives at our fingertips. Now that we've gotten through our game, you've gotten full marks, by the way, so maybe that game was easier than 20 questions, or maybe that game was easier than my listener limerick challenge.
Yeah, I think that was a lot easier than the limerick challenge. I was secretly dreading that, so I'm actually quite relieved I got that, to be fair.
The trick is I only write limericks for stories that I enjoy, so there was never a universe in which I was going to write limericks for Slipback.
There once was a story called Slipback, written by a terrible hack. That could be a good start. One thing I did notice on the Saywood agenda, there was a line that's not in the book, which is in the radio version. And the computer says, "You're a great disappointment, Doctor." And the Doctor says, "Most people feel that way." I suspect that was the writer's bias coming through there.
That almost sounds like a Colin Baker ad-lib, because that would have been written at the time of cancellation.
I'm not sure they'd fallen out by that point. I think they fell out sort of mid-trial, did they?
Yeah, Saywood storms off the show in the middle of trial of a timeline because he had a terrible idea for an ending and JNT wouldn't let him use it. But this came out during the hiatus, so the show had actually been canceled. So I don't know if that was a Colin Baker ad-lib about the fact that he was the Doctor who quote-unquote got the show canceled. We now know, of course, that he was terrific and had nothing to do with him, but it's an interesting line, but by the time the book comes out, the show has been renewed and is back on the air. So maybe that line no longer, maybe it was a meta line that no longer fits.
I mean, these days with the Big Finish and the complexities of some of their stories and the production values of a lot of their stories, Slipback feels quite sort of naive in its way, but I still do quite like it. I feel very nostalgic when I listen to it. I felt quite nostalgic rereading it. That was, I mean, as we were talking before, he was sort of saying, what was your response to it? And I have to say, my response was nostalgia. I was sort of like, it was quite nice being taken back to that canal boat holiday and remember reading it. And I remember buying the cassette in Birmingham and returning home and being really keen to listen to it. And living in a small bedsit when I first moved up here, not much money, and listening to Slipback on my little cassette player. So it's, yeah, it's, it it has its place. For all its faults, it has its place, I think. And I find it hard to be negative about a lot of Doctor Who. I adore Doctor Who, always have. It's had a major part of my life. Majority of my friends I've made through Doctor Who, so I find it hard to criticise it. And I've got people now tell me, oh, they don't like this and they don't like that. And I think, well, I do. Why tell me that? So it's... but, yeah, so possibly not the best book in the world, but I really have enjoyed revisiting it. So thank you for that.
So I have to say, I love your attitude to this, because there are a lot of Doctor Who podcasts out there that are hate watches or hate listens. And I don't want to be a part of that. Like you say, I love Doctor Who. I've made a lot of friends from it. I've made even more friends through this podcast, which is now in its fourth calendar year. I want to enjoy Doctor Who, so I try and be positive about everything on the show, even the TV stories of which I am less fond or books of which I am less fond. I always try to have something nice to say about the topic of the week. And then, of course, you know, I have my long-running mock feud with Fraser about the Dominators. That's never going away. But this is a this is meant to be, at heart, a positive show, and I take these books very seriously, and I certainly have never outgrown them.
And my opinion does change as well. I have noticed when I did my rewatch, my opinion of a lot of stories altered. I mean, we've had discussions in the past about the Daleks' Master Plan. Well, I really loved it this time. I found this, I think it's Josh Snare's done a lot of sort of like reconstructions, which you can find on Daily Motion. And that really brought it back to life for me. So I really loved it this time. It's possibly my favourite story that season. Well, no, I think Mythmakers is still probably my favourite. But my opinion of it changed vastly. So I think revisiting these things, your opinion of it can change. So maybe you'll read the slip back again when you're doing the third version of this podcast in 30 years' time in your dotage, and you might actually adore it. Who knows?
There are, of course, people who believe that I'm in my dotage now. But yes, maybe the geezer edition of Doctor Who literature in the year 2054.
Having your daughters do that.
Having a very sharp 13-year-old daughter who constantly tracks how I'm shrinking and how my hair is graying and disappearing, yes. But what I want to say is, I guess the problem for me with Slipback is that when I was doing my pilgrimage and I was watching all these Doctor Whos again while on lockdown in 2020 and 2021, every episode was my favorite for some small length of time. Even though Android Invasion, I think, is a mess, part one is really, really good. Even though there are parts of Dalek's Master Plan that I want to fast forward through to get to the better stuff, even the weak parts of Dalek's Master Plan have Peter Butterworth in them. So, with the exception of Survival, which I really, really have a problem with, every other Doctor Who serial I really enjoyed, and I came out of it adding Paradise Towers, which I hated as a teenager, to my top 60 all time. So the pilgrimage for me was very, very positive. And I wish I could photograph your expression, but you had a comical reaction to my love of Paradise Towers.
Oh, my estimation of you just plummeted, right? You're dead to me now.
Here's the thing. Paradise Towers, if you're watching Doctor Who in sequence, and I was, it is the first story since Vengeance on Varus that has no continuity whatsoever. It's the first Doctor Who story in two full calendar years that doesn't require you to have an encyclopedic, Ian Levine-esque memory of the show. Secondly, even though it is based on the most nihilistic novel of all time, J.G. Ballard's High Rise, it is the most optimistic Doctor Who story, and every element of Paradise Towers, the caretakers, the Rezzies, the Kangs, Pecks, they all come together in part four, and they're going to put on a show right here, and they all work together to save the day. And it's a wonderful inversion, because when I read High Rise, that book set me into a spiral for quite a long time. But Paradise Towers is such a wonderful spin on it with a happy ending. So
he didn't fancy eating a dog then after reading it.
Exactly.
Roast a dog and read, yeah.
And Tom Hiddleston is a much darker for the movie.
I bought that. I never watched it yet. It's on the shelf there. I purchased it and never got around to watching it.
But yeah, I was going to say, but Paradise Towers during that pilgrimage just hit me in a wonderful way. And that's why it's at the bottom of my top 60. It's number 59, I think, but it's in my top 60. I had never listened. I didn't listen to Slipknot in the 80s because I didn't have access to it. I didn't hear it for the first time until 1997 in the middle of a very long day in the car. And I didn't read the book until 2024 when society is falling apart around us. So had I experienced Slipknot when I was younger, I might have a much more positive, nostalgic take on it. But reading the book now, I'm in the middle of a weaker run of Doctor Who because we also had Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma, and we have some of the less successful novelizations came out in 1986, like Time Lash. So maybe I'm a little burning out on the project, but this book hit me in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I wish I had your attitude towards it. I really do, because your attitude embodies what this podcast is about. And right now, my attitude embodies what this podcast should never be, which is a hate watch.
But that's one of the reasons I've enjoyed. I mean, it took me a long time to get to your podcast because you weren't on Apple for a while, were you? Because that's what I listen to my podcast on. But now you're on YouTube, which is all these plugs I'm doing for you. You're on YouTube now, which is a good way to access as well, a good way to comment on it as well, because of course you can't comment on Apple.
Yes.
But going back to these books, it's just shown how important they are for so many people. I mean, as I said before, these books were a vast part of me learning to read, really, and wanting to learn to read because I wanted to know these stories. And especially Terence Dix's prose was just perfect for introduction to teach people to read. But then you get books like this, which tried something different. I mean, we could argue it's perhaps not terribly successful. At least it attempted something different and a break away from the Terence norm. But maybe Sayers never just found his own writing style, really. He's either trying to be Robert Holmes or he's trying to be Douglas Adams. But I have to say, as a teenager, I loved his stuff. I mean, his stories, when they're on the telly, were usually my favourites of the year. I mean, Resurrection of the Daleks was good. Earthshock was astounding. I adored that. Visitation was adorable. Revelation, I adored. So maybe for a teenager, he was just the perfect writer for Doctor Who.
Well, I'm going to give you the last word. Keith, thank you so much for joining us today. If I have you back, it'll be towards the end of the run of Doctor Who Lit, because I do have the show booked up until the final couple of months, but we'll talk about it.
Lovely. Thanks again for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.
Doctor Who, Slipback, written by Eric Sayward, broadcast as Slipback, radio play by Eric Sayward, radio broadcast in July and August 1985, paperback release date January 15th, 1987, cover artist Paul Mark Tams. The TARDIS materializes on board the Vipod Moor, a galactic survey ship captained by the repulsive Orlus Mostyn Slarn. Things are not going too well on board the spacecraft. A mysterious killer stalks the ship's infrastructure. A junior officer, whose body is 4 years older than his brain, commands its bridge. The craft's computer seems to be developing its own distinctive personality, and Slarn threatens to vent his vindictive anger on his crew. Soon the Doctor and Perry stumble upon a shocking secret, a secret upon which depends the fate of the entire universe. The novelization of the Radio 4 Doctor Who story. We discuss the prologue to the book in the cold open. As for the text of the actual chapters novelizing the 6 10-minute radio episodes, who cares? I can't do it. I just can't. Let's talk instead about New Who. Callie and I watched Space Babies shortly after it dropped on Friday evening, May the 10th, here in New York, and then The Devil's Chord on Saturday morning, the day before this episode releases. We also watched the last 3 episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 4, the last of those with Callie's friend Gabby, and Callie is definitely more into Buffy than into Who. But here are brief, mostly non-spoilery reviews from me, with thoughts from her where signposted on the 2 episodes. Space Babies. A lot of bodily function humor. That's not my thing. Never has been. If that's what Doctor Who was when I started watching the Peter Davison years as a tween, I would never have become a fan. This is not a fault of Space Babies, it's just that I'm out of the show's target demographic. With that out of the way, there was a lot to like. This is basically the new series, not the new series anymore, so it's a pilot, with lots and lots of continuity given early, and some direct quotes from 2005, the same way that 2005 quoted from 1970. I really admire the parallels with Shuri Gatwa's childhood and the in-your-face politics about genocide and then abortion. That stuff I am in the target demo for. The space babies trundling around in their motorized strollers reminded me a little bit of Dalek travel machines. I'm sure that same thought had to be going through the minds of the production team, although there's no reference to it on camera or in the script. Callie loved Millie Gibson's energy and Ruby Sunday's self-assurance. Also, Shuri Gatwa's costume. She actually wanted to start the next episode immediately after Space Babies ended. A huge parenting win, but I didn't want to watch two back-to-back in the same night, so we saved Devil's Cord for the next morning. That's a 4 out of 10 for me. I will never, ever watch this episode again, and I'm not even sure that I want to read the rumored book. But at least 7 out of 10 is a mission statement for the new series, the show for 8 to 12-year-olds that parents in their 30s and early 40s can enjoy on an adult level. The Devil's Cord was much more to my liking. I will confess, as a boring, vanilla, 50-year-old lawyer who's never watched an episode of RuPaul's Drag Race and has never seen anything else with Jinx Monsoon in it before today, Jim Sangster is my guide through that world, and I refer you to his appearance on Reality Bomb when Monsoon's casting was first announced. But I was impressed with the energy in the performance. Doctor Who, since the late 1970s, has been synonymous with huge, over-the-top guest star turns. This almost turns Graham Crowden's turn in The Horns of Nymon into a teeth-clenched, determined Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. Where Space Babies was all about quoting from the 2005 season and leading into the Timeless Child story arc, Devil's Cord is all about resetting the classic series. The Doctor saying he lives in Shoreditch, Susan, the remount of a famous scene from Pyramids of Mars Part 2, and the billboard for Chris Waits and the Carolers, which if you didn't recognize it, go back and listen to the first 40 seconds of this episode, which is a clip taken from Anthony Coburn's An Unearthly Child, Part 1, Doctor Who's first episode, November 23rd, 1963. While I want the new series to stand on its own 2 feet and not be beholden to 60-year-old continuity, I am a sucker for classic series references, and these made me very, very happy indeed, as did June Hudson's cameo. It was painfully clear that none of the stars were playing the piano on their own. I am surprised that Monsoon or Millie Gibson doesn't have those skills, but I took piano lessons for 5 years, and while I can no longer sight-read sheet music, I can still play a piece with sufficient practice, so this being a music-themed episode also rated it highly for me. Callie's big complaint is that the episode builds up the importance of Millie, Ruby Sunday, as the last person on Earth to hear music, but then doesn't follow through with that in the resolution to the climax. Circling back around to the Beatles, well, two of them at least, who appeared briefly earlier in the episode, was a nice touch if you're a fan, and the closing sequence was very cute and catchy. This was a confident production, but I'm an older viewer, I like drama, I like emotional heft, and this was a bit more of a confection for me, age 50. I would give this a 6 out of 10 at least, though unlike Space Babies, I can see myself watching this again. It was an 8 out of 10 for Callie, who loved the costumes, the animated piano notes, the Abbey Road keyboard. There was a reference to the Ronnie in Episode 1, and a reference to Susan in Episode 2. Will we see those names again this season? Next time on Doctor Who Literature. After a long break where we have a target novelization podcast, which really doesn't discuss novelizations of TV episodes, we are back for a long run of TV episode novelizations. In fact, we're going back to the Peter Davison era, We're going back to what was chronologically the first of the Peter Davison two-parters, although it is the last of those two-parters to be novelized, and it is the final Peter Davison novelization of the 20th century. My good friend Stephen B. from the New to Who podcast is coming to us from the other side of the world. I am very looking forward to recording with him about Doctor Who, Black Orchid. We will get our 1920s music on. We will dance to Charleston. Hopefully we'll talk about one of my favorite 1920s vocalists, Annette Hanshaw. It's going to be a positive Odin. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. This podcast is executive produced by David Barsky and produced by Jim Sangster and yours truly. This week's episode was written by me and Roger Ebert and Anthony Coburn. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Keith Say from Trap One. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages. Maestro.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.